Good morning, Council.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Take a moment and get organized. I know you're both extremely familiar with our procedures, so I'll just give you a moment to prepare for argument. And then whenever you're ready, Mr. Keeler, feel free to begin.
May it please the Court, Council. My name is Stan Keeler, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Jermaine Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is challenging his conviction for first-degree arson and also his sentence of 192 months and upward durational departure, almost double departure. Counsel for the state has informed me that the state concedes the sentencing issue, so that will necessarily shift the emphasis of my argument here a little bit. As the court is aware, under State versus Hanuxala and other subsequent cases, the court is not bound by the agreement of the parties and has an independent duty to find or state the law as it may be. So, and my understanding, although counsel can certainly outline the scope of her concession on the sentencing issue, I do intend to briefly discuss the pattern of criminal conduct issue and the issues that raises. It's my understanding from counsel that the state, at the least, would concede that there is not evidence in those certified copies of conviction, which is mostly register of actions and Rule 15 petitions. There is not evidence to prove the nature of those offenses to show that there was an actual escalation of criminal behavior. And it's our position that under the statute and under the Gorman case and McClinton that go back a number of years, the statute requires a similarity of conduct in each prior conviction. And that simply is not shown by an escalation, which requires a comparison of one offense to the other. Furthermore, the legislature certainly has had an opportunity since the Gorman case in the mid-90s to amend the statute if it thought that that Gorman definition, which basically looks to Spriegel similarity, was too narrow, and the legislature has not touched the statute. So with that, unless there are further questions, I would like to move on to the other two issues and perhaps return to the sentencing issue. Now, the first issue raised in the brief was a speedy trial violation. Mr. Jefferson's trial proceeded on about the 120th day. There was a one-day continuance there. And the district court believed at the time that the 120-day deadline in the rule, which provides for the non-monetary release on non-monetary conditions, was what governed the speedy trial setting. But that's not correct under Rule 11.09. It was a 60-day deadline that should have been complied with. And the
60-day deadline gives rise to a presumption of a speedy trial violation, which triggers analysis of other factors.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, and under those other factors, and I'm looking particularly at the second Barker factor, which is the reason for the delay, the court initially, Judge Norris, in the pretrial hearing, ascribed the delay to the defense's late alibi notice. However, the length of the continuance that was granted and also the actual statement of the judge indicates that the state's need for more time for the DNA testing was the principal reason for this continuance, which was basically 4 months. It's 120 days from the date of the speedy trial demand. Now, the state is arguing that the defense should be required to show some specific prejudice from this delay. But under Griffith, the opinion of this court, it's too difficult to show a specific prejudice to the defense of a criminal case, and therefore the presumptive prejudice should apply, and the defense should not be required to show a specific impact on elements either of the state's case or of the defense. And in this case, where two of the state's witnesses never appeared for trial, and the state, the prosecutor, relied heavily on hearsay statements of those declarants, it's rather impossible to say that the delay did not have an impact on the trial of this case.
But are you making an argument that if those witnesses would have been available, they would have helped the defense?
No, I'm simply arguing that the defendant had a right to confront their testimony, and perhaps, although without their testimony, it's impossible to say exactly how they would have testified or
But in the briefing, it strikes me as odd that you're not actually challenging the district court's rulings regarding the admission of all this alleged hearsay or asserting a confrontation clause violation. You're arguing prosecutorial misconduct. In other words, that's the framework you chose to challenge the admission of hearsay. So I mean, it seems inconsistent to say, well, there was a speedy trial violation because there was prejudice based on the lack of right of confrontation when there's not actually an argument that there was a confrontation clause violation in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not waiving a hearsay argument here. I believe that many of those instances in which the court overruled a hearsay objection, it was an erroneous ruling.
Okay, but you've not briefed any of that. You've not made that argument in your briefing. You've simply asserted that the prosecutor engaged in misconduct by eliciting clearly inadmissible evidence.
Well, I'm arguing that that evidence wasn't admissible, and that's the basis for my prosecutorial misconduct argument, which presumes that that hearsay should not have been admitted.
But can we talk about that for a moment, the prosecutorial misconduct argument? Because the cases on which you rely for the proposition, and it is established in case law, that a prosecutor engages in misconduct by eliciting evidence he knows is clearly inadmissible, seem to describe situations in which a district court has ruled that something is inadmissible, a line of questioning can't be pursued, and the prosecutor nonetheless persists in attempting to elicit the information or does not adequately prepare his or her witness such that the witness doesn't disclose information. That scenario seems far different than what we have here, which is a prosecutor asking questions that could elicit hearsay testimony in the sense that we don't have an advance ruling. The prosecutor doesn't know with certainty that this is hearsay, it's inadmissible because the issue's not been raised or decided by the court. Isn't there a distinction between what happened in this case and the circumstances in the cases that establish this line of prosecutorial misconduct?
There may be some distinctions, Your Honor, but at least with respect to some of the testimony, the court sustained hearsay objections to what Teresa Mary had said about how appellant took the breakup.
But then if we accept your argument, then would we be saying that prosecutor asks a question, objection, hearsay, sustained. This now means as a matter of law the prosecutor has engaged in misconduct?
No, it's the pursuit thereafter that I think begins to be misconduct.
And I appreciate that in your brief. You say, well, the prosecutor continued to ask questions, but kind of in looking at the record, I'm not seeing a circumstance where an objection was sustained, the prosecutor pursued in the line of questioning, and an objection was again made, much less sustained. Instead, I see examples where the prosecutor's questioning was objected to, objection was sustained, the prosecutor rephrased the questioning in a way that did not result in further objection. How can we say that's misconduct if the prosecutor is changing his or her approach in response to the district court's ruling and not prompting another objection?
Well, Your Honor, I think at least in one instance here with Teresa Mary, the question was not rephrased, not substantially rephrased. The prosecutor simply went back and had another whack at it.
Was there an objection or a ruling?
I can't speak to that particular instance, but it's clear from the whole pattern of the prosecutor's examination of his witnesses that he was going back to this hearsay. He kept going back to it. And in at least that instance, and I believe also with Detective McCarg, he had received adverse rulings as to the admissibility of those statements. On all those statements went back to things that the Mitchell family members who weren't testifying had said about defendant's threats, appellant's threats, or appellant's upset, being upset at the breakup.
Can you cite to an example in the record where there was an objection to testimony that would have described alleged threats that was actually sustained? Because as I read your summary of the objections in the brief, I was left with the impression that although there were objections to testimony because it would have revealed these alleged threats, those objections were overruled.
I can do that on rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay. And my reason for asking is because then I'm left wondering how I would conclude that a prosecutor engaged in misconduct for asking a question about threats when the district court ruled that the question was not objectionable.
Well, I'll attempt to address that on rebuttal, but I don't think, and this is perhaps why one reason why I'm framing this as an issue of prosecutorial misconduct, I don't think it's fair for the prosecutor to force the defense counsel into a constant objection.
The defense counsel could make a motion in limine. If you're about to start the trial and you know the witnesses aren't there, the defense counsel could say, we move for a pretrial order, establishing what evidence may not be admitted, what lines of questioning may not be pursued, which is exactly the type of order you see in the prosecutorial misconduct case, that the defense gets a ruling up front about what the parameters are, and the prosecutor then violates the order.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the defense counsel could act preemptively, and there are things that could be done. But forcing the counsel to continuously object in front of the jury is a burden, it seems to me, on the trial tactics of a defense attorney. And if the prosecutor, who here openly elicited character evidence on two occasions without any justification.
Can I ask about that? Because I know your time's limited, but I'm struggling with the character evidence argument. The argument seems to be that the mother's testimony that I don't like the way he treated my daughter, I don't like the way he talked to her, and the brother's testimony that I got him a job interview, he blew it off, that was inadmissible character evidence under 404B, and notice was required. I'm struggling with whether that is 404B evidence. I mean, I tend to agree with you, completely irrelevant, no business coming in, but I don't know that that means it's 404B character evidence. In other words, do we really think that the jury, upon hearing that someone blew off a job interview, is going to light a residential apartment complex on fire? I mean, does the prior bad act really suggest conduct in conformity therewith, that is, conduct that is similar, there's some sort of similarity between the prior act and the crime charged?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that it's covered by 404B. That's not my principal argument. And I'm not arguing that it has any
similarity. And I misunderstood, because I thought the briefing talked about 404B, there's no notice. So I was left with the impression that you were saying this was inadmissible under 404B and the prosecutor should have known it because there was no notice given.
No, that was not my principal argument. It's just plain old character evidence that would not even come close to being admissible under Rule 404B.
Well, what rule are you saying was violated by the admission of that evidence?
Well, there's a general rule that you cannot, the defendant does not put his character in issue, even if he had taken the stand. You can't, it's too prejudicial to bring out bad character evidence against the defendant.
But doesn't Rule 404 govern the admission of character evidence?
It does, but it's come to be known more for its exceptions than for the general rule. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to make sure I understand your argument, because if the argument is the prosecutor engaged in misconduct by eliciting evidence in violation of the rules of evidence, or which was clearly inadmissible under the rule, I need to know what rule you're talking about. And I was seeing cites to 404B and a complaint that prior notice had not been provided regarding these prior bad acts. You know, it sounds like you're backing away from that argument.
No, I would rely principally on case law saying the character evidence is inadmissible, and I believe that Rule 404 does also say that.
Okay.
But I see my time is
Thank you, Mr. Keeler.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
We'll have that. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state. I would, to clarify, I did this morning, after consulting and reviewing the record a little bit further, realize that there is not a sufficient factual basis with regard to the third issue to support the Blakely findings. Although I could try, as I might argue, that it shows a pattern of lawlessness and increased behavior that's escalating, I can't find a case that supports that. So
does that... That satisfies the definition of pattern as set forth by the Supreme Court.
Correct, Your Honor.
Even if you can show that, I'm not sure that there's a case that says that satisfies the statutory definition as articulated by the Supreme Court.
Exactly, Your Honor, which is why I couldn't defend that with a straight face.
So your position is we should remand for resentencing?
Correct, Your Honor. And if I believe it was an 81-month departure, so the presumptive here was 111 months, and the ultimate sentence was 192 months. But if it's remanded, it would just be with regard to the Blakely, nothing else regarding the sentence.
Reverse and remand for imposition of a presumptive sentence under the guidelines.
Yes, Your Honor. Otherwise, with regard to the speedy trial issue, first to address that, I would note that the alibi defense, it involved a video of surveillance footage that was alleged to depict the defendant going to Children's Medical Hospital to visit his daughter. There's an order dated on July 25th, 2017, and I apologize, I don't have the index number. That's when the district court actually ordered that footage be turned over to the district or to the defendant. And so the 4 days before the June 19th trial date when the alibi was disclosed, that puts us at June 15th. So it wasn't a quick turnaround to do the investigation here. The footage wasn't available until more than a month later. And the district court, I believe it was Judge Lionel Norris, said specifically that alone was good cause to do the extension, which an extension for something that the defendant's making is not to be treated as a violation of his or her speedy trial rights. Additionally, with regard to the DNA, that had to do with something that was a glove that was on the scene, and they were anticipating receiving the records with that in August. And I'm sorry, Your Honor?
No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just was seeking your clarification with respect to this. It appeared from your brief that the appellant himself opposed the continuance at that time, but his counsel made some more equivocal statement. Could you speak to that?
Yes, Your Honor. It appears that defense counsel wanted the continuance to further investigate the alibi. I believe at that time they probably didn't have the video. And so then the defendant was saying, or appellant was basically saying, no, I'm fine, we can move forward. So there's a bit of a confusion there. However, ultimately the continuance was granted. Mm-hmm. So, but he equivocates, but he had still issued his speedy trial demand at that point. So after that, we do get to the 119th day of trial, and then there is mention in appellant's brief with regard to a short continuance for a half day following before the jury was sworn in. This has to do with witness issues, which were discussed, and in fact, if you look at the transcript talking about the first day of trial, the defendant didn't even want to plead guilty because he thought the victim wasn't going to show up, which is in fact what ended up happening. The state was able to prove the case without the victim because of other circumstantial evidence, as well as the strength of the case with video putting him at the scene within minutes of the fire and right near where the fire was set. And so this is something where I have a hard time seeing how the failure to call the state's witness would have, calling the state's main victim in this case would have benefited the defendant in this case and would have prejudiced him by her not appearing in that instance. Moving on to the evidentiary rulings, I would agree with Judge Larkin that it's not... The prosecutor here, although may not have artfully ask the questions, he did rephrase when there was an objection and it was sustained. And there were multiple times where it was sustained and the evidence was stricken. And the jury was specifically instructed to not consider that evidence. And the jury is presumed to follow the court's instruction in that instance. So I do not believe here that this would establish sufficient plain error to have substantially affected the verdict in this instance because of that. And when it was rephrased, then there was no objection, and then the evidence properly came in. Often it was effect on listener. It would have to do with why the investigation went in a certain direction, things of that nature. With regard to the character evidence, I don't see it as being something that is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It could have also been phrased a little better with regard to getting it in, rather than asking a follow-up of the mother, what do you mean by that? It should have just been moved on. However, there was no objection here. So I would submit that that is also not significant enough to have had a substantial impact on this verdict when you look at the overwhelming evidence here. They have the individual getting into the apartment complex, being seen going down the stairwell. He's carrying something when he comes into the building. 2 minutes later, he's also on video in the underground garage. 2 minutes later, he's leaving. He's no longer carrying anything. And lo and behold, there's been a fire that's been set in that underground stairwell where over 100 people lived in this building. So unless there are further questions from the court, I would rest on my brief.
Thank you, Ms. Lahn.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Keeler, rebuttal.
As far as the hearsay issue and the repetition of that, I believe on page 57 of the transcript, I'm sorry, I may have to refer to it. On page 58, Your Honor, the witness's statement that she said that he was upset, in other words, her daughter, the former girlfriend, said that he was upset. Objection for hearsay is sustained. And I believe on the page 59, yes. Where the prosecutor asks, did your daughter tell you, without telling you what it is, did your daughter tell you about how Jefferson took the breakup? Well, he didn't like it. He was upset. And then the prosecutor again says, without telling us what your daughter told you. And in other words, the prosecutor made some attempt to limit that to, I guess, to her opinion or whatever it may have been, but I don't see what the mother had any other basis for knowing how a defendant or appellant took the breakup other than what her daughter had told her. So he may have rephrased the question, but essentially it was eliciting or seeking to elicit the same hearsay. Now, I guess I understand the state's concession to be, as far as the legal issues and the sentencing, that it cannot find a case that would support escalating behavior fitting within a pattern or satisfying the statutory requirement of a pattern of criminal conduct. I would argue that not only is there not a case, but the language that is out there, the cases that are out there, meaning Gorman and McClinton, indicate that the prior convictions must have a characteristic in which they are similar, but not identical, but similar to the current offense. So under that construction of the language, which, as I said before, the legislature has not seen fit to address, there is no similarity that would be created by a period of escalation. And so, I guess I would urge the court to delve into that issue, despite the state's concession here, which is, I guess, limited to the facts of this case and to the procedure and to the lack of documentary evidence presented on these prior convictions. As on the speedy trial issue, I believe that district court's own statements would negate an inference that this continuance was granted because of a four-day.
Let's assume we were to look at this and say, given the length of the continuance, you're right, it looks like we were accommodating the state's request for DNA testing rather than a late alibi disclosure. Does it make a difference in the balance? I mean, the district court also said it saw no evidence of intentional delay relating to the DNA continuance request that would cause the delay to be weighed heavily against the state. Because even if it's weighed against the state, is it heavily or not? It depends on whether it was sort of negligent or intentional. Are you arguing that this was some sort of intentional delay by the state, or do you accept the district court's conclusion that although the state's at fault for the delay related to the DNA testing, it wasn't intentional delay meant to hamper the defense?
Well, certainly I could not prove intent on the part of the prosecutor. However, DNA testing delays are rather common, and the state did not present any DNA evidence here. I recognize that that falls far short of showing intent, but the length of the delay is one of the factors, and so whether it was due to the alibi, which would require a brief delay, or DNA testing, which would require a rather lengthy delay, you know, that affects also another of the Barker factors. So I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Keeler. Thank you, Ms. Lawan. Case has been submitted.